Hello, and welcome to Faithfully Helpless. Every Thursday at 8 a.m., this show presents the opportunity to hear from interesting people and to learn about the role that faith plays in their lives. We're broadcast from WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Maggie Schaumleffel from the Barth House Episcopal Center of the Diocese of West Tennessee. The Barth House, if you haven't heard of it, serves as a hub for college ministry. We also offer a space for faith groups and secular community enriching groups and the celebration of the arts and how they present our God-given gifts of creativity. Today's show is one of the series offered by Faithfully Memphis called Behold It Unveiled, where we're talking about art, creativity, and spirituality. Our guest today is Kyle Tobkin. Welcome, Kyle.
Hello. Thank you.
Really, really glad you're here. I'm excited for this conversation.
Me too.
Could you introduce yourself and tell us who you are?
Sure. So my name is Kyle. I'm a filmmaker and a freelance videographer and editor here in Memphis, Tennessee.
Wow. And you do some awesome stuff. I want to go ahead and get that out of the way because I had the opportunity to be introduced to Kyle through, we were doing a filmmaker showcase, and Kyle was our filmmaker that we were showcasing. And watching his films, I was moved greatly. And with the creativity and spirituality theme of Behold It Unveiled, something that I've heard before, and it's a truth for me, is that because we're made in the image of God, a creator, then we are all also creators. And I just love to see people work in it. And I think you do that, Kyle. So I'm excited about our conversation today. We'll start with, there's a segment that Faithfully Memphis often does called The Saint of the Day, which a lot of times makes me really, really nervous because I don't often know much about the saint. Didn't know anything about this guy, but I did want to talk about him a minute. The saint honored on November 17th in the Episcopal Church is Saint Hugh of Lincoln. He was born around the year 1135 in Avalon, France. He started as a Benedictine monk and then became a Carthusian monk. He was a church builder in the literal and figurative sense. So he actually did oversee the building of different monasteries and churches, but also he went into some and found them in disarray and brought them to life and put order into them. Okay, so when he came to England, part of Henry II's penance for the assassination of Thomas Becket was he was going to build monasteries, and Carthusian monasteries were being built. And so Hugh came into England, and because Henry had heard of Hugh's successes, and he appointed him prior of the new Carthusian Charterhouse. In May of 1186, Henry II oversaw Hugh being elected the new bishop of the Cathedral Chapter of Lincoln. So, I mean, he got his job from the king, right? The king talked to all his friends and said, yeah, we should elect this guy. Who's going to say no to the king, right? But what's cool about that is that Hugh insisted on a second private election held by the canons in the chapter house. Like, they locked the doors and it was the canons who elected him. Rather than in the king's chapel, like, his election was confirmed by that result. So he was, I liked how he processed it. I mean, he didn't just take it and run with it. I want to go ahead. Okay, so the cool thing about Hugh, this is what I thought was exciting, Kyle. He held the crown to standards of honoring the church, and he actually upset his relationship with Henry II. If not having to insist on having his election confirmed by his own folk didn't upset him enough, then he went even further. He established his independence of the king, excommunicating a royal forester, refusing to seat one of Henry's courtly nominees. They had a frigid relationship. They barely spoke. But he softened the king's anger with his diplomatic address and his tactful charm, which I think he ribbed him. So this is how the story goes. He's, after the excommunications, he came upon the king hunting and was greeted with dour silence. I mean, it's got to feel a little scary. Like, this is the guy who we attribute Thomas Becket's assassination with. And you meet him, and he's just silent towards you. He gives you the silent treatment. But then the king called for some string to tie up a leather bandage that he was putting on his finger. And Hugh said, with gentle mockery, "How much you remind me of your cousins of Falaise," which the reason why that's interesting is because part of his family, Henry II's family, there was an unmarried mother who was a tanner's daughter. So he's saying that you remind me of this part of your family that you're not so proud of because of how you're tying up this leather on your finger, which is so bold, right? Like, I liked that. I loved that boldness. And Henry II's response was, he just burst out laughing and they were friends again. It all was merry and bright. But as a bishop, Hugh was exemplary. He was constantly in residence or traveling with his diocese. He was generous with his charity, and he was scrupulous in the appointments he made. It wasn't just you can buy it kind of deal, which, anyhow, you couldn't just buy your way into the church under Hugh. He raised the quality of education at the cathedral school, and he was also, like, his legacy is, part of his legacy is prominent in how he tried to protect the Jews that lived in Lincoln, a lot of Jewish people that lived in Lincoln and were feeling the persecution at the beginning of Richard I's reign. He put down popular violence against them. He spoke out against it, which I moved a lot by Hugh's story. He was canonized in 1220, and he's the patron saint of sick children, sick people, shoemakers, and swans. Okay, and his icon, I know, right? Like, so I couldn't even, I'm like, okay, sick people, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know why, but I was like, I got to know about the swans. I got to know about the swans, right? And his iconography, if you see a statue or an icon of somebody who is sainted and they're with a swan, it's going to be St. Hugh of Lincoln. And the reason behind that is, I don't know which one, but at one of the monasteries where he was, they had swans on the grounds, and there was one particular swan that followed him everywhere he went. I know, right? And slept by his bed. And if anybody else tried to come near him, the swan would attack him.
Wait, but don't swans, like, think they're people in a way?
Oh.
Isn't that a thing?
Okay, with, now, like, I'm going to have to look up into with
a
person? This.
I think that's a thing. But maybe I'm wrong.
Hey, it's Emily. I don't know if that's a thing. I know that geese are, they definitely think they're people and are, I mean, maybe the rough side of people, the unhappy side of people. But I'm just over here. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm just over here swooning over this nice little swan who was following him around. That's just really tickling me.
Oh, know? Father it, Noah at the bathhouse said he had a guard swan. Like,
okay, where is Noah? Can we get him on the line? I want the story.
No, yeah. So I love that idea. So, you know it's St. Hugh if you see him with a swan. And now I'm going to have to go do a lot more research on swans and geese. Okay, that's our saint of the day. So that's our segment, which I love sharing.
Amazing. Fun.
The smallest hours of the morning,
We just listened to a song. If you're listening live, you heard the song. And this is, Kyle has chosen some music for us to augment our journey in our conversation today. So what song did we just listen to? And you have a, kind of a really cool story about that. Will you share it with us?
Yeah, so this is a song called Dog Eaten by a band called Water Liars, an incredible band, one of my favorite bands of all time. They were from Oxford, Mississippi. They made three incredible albums and a fourth that was released sort of later after the band had broken up. And quick plug, they're about to actually reunite and play through their entire discography in March in Oxford. And it's the first time they've played together in several years.
Wow.
So that's super exciting. Anyway, this song is the song that plays at the end of a short film of mine called The Butcher, a film that's got incredible meaning to me personally, and this song just continues to move me deeply. But what's sort of wild about this, on theme with talking about spirituality and creativity, I was writing the script for this short film and sort of preparing to make it sort of in a point in my process when I'm just dreaming about what it could be, dreaming about what it might look like, what it might sound like, what it might feel like. And as a part of that process, I listen to a lot of music. I look at a lot of films or imagery or art that helps get me into some sort of emotional space that feels kindred to whatever piece I might be getting ready to make. And I've been trying to figure out sort of what I wanted to do with the music in the film. And I actually used classical music for most of the film. But I knew that at the end I wanted a needle drop, which is a pre-existing song that underscores a scene. And had thought about using a Water Liars track, a different Water Liars track, for a little while. And my wife and I were traveling, and we were in Europe. We were at an airport in Amsterdam, and I was feeling conflicted about what to do, about which song to use, because though these things may not be super meaningful on a big scale to me when I'm making them, they mean everything. And I was walking through the airport, went to get a cup of coffee, and I heard this Water Liars song playing in the airport in Amsterdam. And it sort of just hit me in the chest that this was some kind of sign
of
some
sort. How could you not use that song?
Right. And what made it so odd was that I was very far away from the United States, very far away from Oxford, Mississippi, where this band was based and started to grow in popularity kind of in and around this area specifically. They played a lot of shows in Memphis. And so I just found that odd. And this song in particular, it wasn't even their most famous song. So it just all sort of pointed me towards using it, but also feeling like I was headed the right way. You know?
Far away from home, far away from where the band is from, and your contemplation wheel of what song am I going to use? Which song am I going to use? And you hear it. I mean, how often could you even hear that song when you're walking around anywhere, let alone in a completely across the world, in
right.
a completely different country?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're talking about the film The Butcher, which is beautiful, I think you used the phrase, it has great meaning for you. Can you share with us, what is that? What is that nugget and how this song bolsters that?
Yeah, sure. Once I started making short films when I was around 20 years old, sort of halfway through undergrad, it sort of brought together all of these disparate elements of my life and interests in this way that I truly felt sort of a calling either being placed on me or that I was discovering. A calling to make films and tell stories that communicate my understanding at any given time of the emotional weight of the human experience. And so I began to do that. And after making several shorts, went to grad school, studied film, made more, and then came back to Memphis. And struggled to find my place kind of post-schooling in Memphis, trying to figure out how to make a living, and struggling to find peace and joy in my life at that period of time. And I went through a period where I didn't make any work for like 3 years and was becoming progressively less fulfilled creatively. And after that period, I sort of was able to work through some of the things that I was dealing with at that time in my life. And the idea for The Butcher sort of began to come to me. And so in a way, it was this return to my love, like this return to my passion, this thing that I love to do. And I cast my dad in the lead role, and we filmed at my parents' house where I grew up and the store where my dad works. My dad is a butcher. And so it was this interesting blend of reality and fiction and filming in places that have a lot of meaning to me. And I just felt an immense amount of support from my family and my friends while I was making that. And so the film, while I look back on it and see technical things that may bother me or I wish I could improve on.
You alone, probably,
right?
Kyle.
it still represents this beautiful time when I was surrounded by love and supported by people that I love. And I sort of began to make films again. And then that sort of was kind of the second wave of a bunch of short films that I've done over the last 4 or 5 years.
I love how at this time where it's that the human experience of the brokenness of not finding all the pieces that, and you stopped creating. And then what was so much of the healing process was creating again and pulling these strands of things that made you tick, like, together into a beautiful creation. Because in that film, one of my interpretations of it is just that search for peace and that search for, and how the people around us and can affect. I mean, I think of like how your airport story of hearing the song and it, the serendipitous nature, the divine intervention nature, the how being in this universe together, we do impact each other and we feel and we feed off of each other. And I think that's a lot of that film.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, I think there was a time in my life when I would have obsessively tried to figure out why that happened. What's the deal with that? And I probably would have come down on the side of it just being random coincidence, right? And that the universe is more or less random chaos. But as I've gotten older and come to have different beliefs about things in this realm, you know, I'm not sure, and that's okay, right? Like, I don't know why I heard that song at that moment in that airport in Amsterdam. Maybe I was just paying attention, and maybe somebody had put on a random playlist and it just so happened to line up that way. Maybe not. I don't really care. Like, all I know is, like, it happened. It had meaning for me, you know, and I think if we, I think that if we continue to sort of tune our antennas to pick up on sort of these subtle nods from the universe, they're there for us.
The universe for all of us. Reaching out to us and us feeling and responding. And I like how, because I'll drive myself crazy with trying to find the why or what. And really, it's just holding it loosely and saying it is, and it's beautiful. And that's all I can know about it if I want to pursue it. So you were talking a little bit about your journey of becoming a filmmaker. I'd like to hear more about that. Somebody who doesn't know nothing about making films and how, and also I have to say, like, I see that work and I'm like, gosh, that would take a million years for me to accomplish. And I'm amazed in the things that I don't even notice. Like, I often think about music in movies and how I didn't even notice that was playing until I actually start trying to listen for music. So as somebody who might annoy you as an audience member, but tell me what that looks like, the journey into becoming a filmmaker.
Well, for me personally, it was a combination of a few things. I was always a creative kid. I was always a highly sensitive person. And I always was sort of looking for ways to express myself. And at the same time, sort of around high school years, I started working would be a really strong term for what we did, but working with the TV station in our high school, which is basically a closet in the library where we did little news announcements and things. So I started to like playing with cameras and editing. So there's kind of a technical thing there. At the time, I was writing songs and playing music and played in a few different bands sort of in high school and college, and thought that that was what I wanted to do for a while. But in college, I started to study media. I did TV, I did radio, I did newspaper. I thought I wanted to do journalism for a moment, you know, when I was thinking about careers I might be interested in. And at the same time, I was having this obsessive relationship with movies and watching tons and tons of movies. And I would play this sort of game where I would watch a film. I would say, wow, I really liked that. I never knew that sort of thing could even exist. Who directed that? What does that mean? Let me watch the other things they made. Oh, wow, I really liked that actor. You know, what else have they been in? Let me watch that thing. Oh, wow, these shots are beautiful. I love the way the shots look. What is that? A cinematographer. What does that mean? Let me do some reading. Wow, I found this cool book that mentions that director of that other thing I watched. You know, so it's this rabbit trail that I followed for many, many years, just learning about...
of how to be a storyteller. Because you're a storyteller and you wanted to... Is that...
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that was the pull to it, but I wasn't maybe aware of that at that time. And then as I was sort of separately finding my interests in all of these areas, it all came together sort of with the first short films I tried to make, where I took cameras from the TV studio at school and I wrote a script and I got my friends, you know, to act in it. And then I went down to the TV studio to edit it. My buddy ran the video yearbook department, and so sometimes he would let me borrow their stuff. And so in that really kind of organic, pure way, it was just me playing with this new medium I had discovered of, like, trying to make little movies. when I was around 20 or 21. And when that happened, as I mentioned before, it sort of all clicked. It all came together for me where I said, oh, this is the thing I'm meant to do.
Did you have a favorite director or film at that age or that time, or has it held true for you now? Or it's
Yes. There were some movies that really blew my mind then that I look back now and I don't think they're quite as good as I did when I was maybe 19 years old.
Yeah.
Right. But
yeah.
Stanley Kubrick was a director that really meant a lot to me and still means a lot to me. His films like 2001: A Space Odyssey. And
Emily Austin's his in films, full agreement over here.
Yeah.
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 We'll have to sidebar that conversation. That's a top five movie for me too. 2001 is.
Yeah, and I think what it is, you know, as a kid or young teenager, you're just watching whatever. Like, I don't even know, Austin Powers or something, like, which I still sort of love, yeah. But. You're just watching whatever's at the theater, mm-hmm. You know, superhero movies or you just don't. I did not know about the entire history of the cinematic medium, of narrative and of the art form, and that there were all of these filmmakers all over the world pushing the boundaries of that language. So it takes it from this kind of fun thing you do on the weekend, your parents drop you off at the movies and you go see, you know, Spider-Man or whatever, to like, oh wow, this is an art form when it's used in this way, in this intentional way, to communicate profound things.
Right. And I mean, not to dog it, but because you use the example, like Austin Powers, you feel something as, you know, and it's the art form of film is that we are a lot of our senses and a lot of our, you know, nervous system reactions are started up because we are experiencing this art form. It's, and that's one of the questions I also have is like, how does the medium of film, and I think you explained it, like, your creative outlet, because it's the whole story. Like, is that serve your creative outlet? Because you can have us hear something and see something and sometimes almost smell it because we see it. I can imagine what the, you know, that back storeroom smells like in the film, or, you know, I'm imagining it as I'm watching it, and you can guide us on that journey through the art form. So like film serves you for your creative outlet. I'm putting this, would you feel hampered if you didn't have that whole experience to express? You talked about being a musician.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would feel like something was missing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I didn't have that medium to use for personal expression in that way, because I'm also not super good at any of the other things I attempted to do in that period. Like, I'm not a great guitar player. I'm a terrible singer. I'm like an okay songwriter. But I didn't really have the juice for any of that stuff the way I did for film. And so it does and did at that time even stand alone from all the other things I might have tried, you know, as a kid.
It has to be film for you for this. And so, because, you know, our subject, and I think we've touched on it, like the relationship between creativity and spirituality. And do you think that your creativity, how much of it, your creativity is born out of spirituality, or how much of your spirituality is born out of creativity?
Yeah, I think the two are inextricably linked, for sure. And I feel in an interesting time in my life where I'm seeing the truth of that in ways that I just wasn't maybe aware of before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there is something to, I think that there is something to individuals taking in reality, taking in their experience of the world and their relationship with and to others, interpreting that through their life experiences, their perspective, their point of view, their voice. And then sort of, I heard this said recently and it really kind of brought it home for me, and reporting back to the rest of us what that is, you know, and bringing to our attention things that we all feel and perceive, but maybe don't intellectualize or think about in a super conscious way.
Yeah, right? Have the consciousness that that is that. Oh, that's my experience too. We may not even realize as we're ingesting the film or the artwork that that's my experience. But we know it zings.
Yeah,
you know, it resonates with us.
Yeah, and so I think in that sense, it is spiritual. It is spiritual work. I do not make faith-based films.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a whole other thing, right? And I do not have any sort of faith agenda. I'm not trying to preach some message, you know, mm-hmm. through something I make. So what we're talking about, I feel, is sort of a totally different mm-hmm. thing than that kind of thing, which is why it's sort of hard to talk about, because I think the minute you introduce the word faith or spirituality, we just bring all our baggage right to it.
Right.
And someone listening to us talk about this might write it off as either wacky or, too Christian, whatever that may mean to them. You know, we need like a definition of terms, I think, sometimes when we have these conversations.
You're right. I can't relate, or I don't want to relate, or that makes good point. So with the themes of your films, do you have a name for a handful of themes that you like to revisit? Like, have you named them? Are you like, or this is what I'm trying to express or say? Do you have some?
Not at all.
No,
I never set out to say something specific.
Wow.
You know, it's always born of a feeling, a mood, a tone. I have things that I'm interested in exploring when I make something, like my most recent short film, which does a lot with cell phones and devices and notifications and news alerts, things we can...
And the name of that award-winning most recent short film is?
It's called Nordo.
Nordo.
Which means no radio. It's a military call sign. So like for that film, you know, I sort of go into it knowing, okay, I kind of want to do something with phones. Like, can I do that? Can I explore that in a meaningful way? But I'm not going, this will be a treaty on phone use in 2022, right? Like, it's never that sort of thing.
And hearing, you know, being able to be at discussions around your films and hearing other people's interpretations of them was a treat for me because, well, and also humbling because it's like, I didn't see it like that at all. Or how did you? And I also really just need to give a shout out because Nordo has stuck with me and is still a film that I talk to other people about.
Thank you.
It's beautiful. I think it has impacted me. And the award that it just won, will you tell us the festival and tell us about that?
Yeah, so it was just named the best hometowner narrative short film at Indie Memphis Film Festival, which
congratulations.
Is, thank you, yeah, which is an amazing honor and incredibly meaningful to me. When I made The Butcher, sort of as we talked about, this kind of first one for me after this long break of not making anything, I can still remember getting sort of notified that they were going to show that film in the festival. And I didn't know anyone in the Memphis film community. I had never really played in a film festival in a meaningful way. And, you know, I can't overstate how impactful that was for me, not necessarily because it was some external validation point, but just because it meant, wow, this worked for someone, and it worked like this worked for them so well that they chose to play it at this film festival that up until that point, you know, I had just dreamed about getting in. And so to then get to show my films there in subsequent years and win that award, you know, it's kind of something I can't really even fully wrap my mind around. You know, if me from 2016 or whatever, you know, just getting the Butcher in had known.
And it's part of the process, which I appreciate you pointing out, like, let's be careful with the terminology. But for me, like, it is that we're given these gifts. As I said, like, I would be terrified to even try to make a film of any sort like that. And so it's when people receive them and see them, I mean, like you said, like, it's not a search for validation, yet the validation matters too, because you have an audience. And when your audience says, I see it and hear it, and it may not even be what you want them to see and hear necessarily, or I feel like you are beautiful in the way that you let your message go and be held by individuals in their individual way, but it is. It matters to have that reciprocation of a community and people saying, yeah, we see what you're doing. We think your compass is set well, kind of.
Yeah, and I think that sort of hints at a whole other side of all of this, which is kind of this kind of practical, pragmatic thing that is the path of someone trying to make a living with their work. And for a filmmaker, that is a Mount Everest of a task, of a goal, right? And so just to have the film selected or the film win an award later, like this film, it's also nice to have those signposts along the way that you're not crazy, that you can do this, you know, maybe. Like, because every time I make something, I think, is this gonna, are people gonna like that? Like, I don't know. Like, because you get so far in, by the time you're sort of calling it quits, which is never like a point where you feel like it's done. You just have to sort of abandon it and say, I gotta let it go. When I get to that point, I am so backwards on my ability to see it clearly and cleanly anymore, because I've been so involved with it from the first inception of the idea all the way to like sort of the final render of the file that I'm going to post for film festivals or whatever. There is a feeling of like, I have no clue if this is going to work at all every time. And so it's just nice to put it out in the world and then have that reaffirm for you that, okay, like, I'm not crazy. This is working. I'm doing something that somebody somewhere thinks is half decent. So maybe I can keep pushing forward.
My mama and I have a thing where, you know, you the person who sat there and made the meal all day long can't taste it the same way as the other people receiving it.
Right.
You know, and it's true in so many different ways. And so I know I want to hear another song, but before you said something interesting. So there's not, is it because that's your deadline? You have an end date that you're like, okay, I'm done after this. I'm not touching it again. And you're still in it up until that point. So it's not I'm finished and this project can rest kind of thing.
I've never experienced a I am finished feeling. No, it's I set deadlines for myself typically based on some realistic deadline for a film festival that I might want to submit to, and I say I need to have it done by that date so I can submit it to that festival for that year.
Yeah.
But really, that's not because I think I would even get into that festival, and this is a whole other conversation we really don't need to get into, but that I even believe that film festivals, for short films at least, can even do that much for someone. That's a sidebar. It's just a way to impose a deadline on myself so that I know when I need to let it let it go when I need to let it out to sea, right? Yeah. And hope for the best.
Wow.
So yeah, I've never experienced that. I'm finished feeling, but I don't know, you know, that I'm supposed to.
That's beautiful, Kyle. I love that thought. Don't know if you're supposed to feel finished. Emily, can we hear the next song coming up?
It doesn't disappear, not even when the moon and earth melt and the sun rolls back the years, and you can't hurt it, you can't bruise it, but you cannot.
So we're back to our conversation with filmmaker Kyle Tobkin. Kyle, tell us about the song that we just heard.
So that that song is called I'll Be True by my childhood friend and good buddy named Crockett Hall. Mm-hmm. And that song means a ton to me and has continued to serve as a huge foundation point for not only another short film I made called Soul Man, but a feature film that I've been working to get made for some years now called I'll Be True. So in the film, the song that the character is most known for is based on this song that that Crockett Hall wrote and recorded. And it's really meaningful because Ben Colley, among a few others, played on this recording. And Ben Colley was the sole survivor of the plane crash that killed Otis Redding and his band. He played on many, many legendary Stax recordings. And he was one of these just legends in Memphis music, and passed away shortly after recording on this song. And this was either the last music he ever recorded or next to the last music that he ever recorded. So it's incredibly meaningful. And we shot the music video for this outside of Stax, mm-hmm. with Stax's permission and involvement. And so, you know, you can kind of see where for me, all of this stuff plays into, all of this kind of goes into the stew of sort of the idea for my feature, for my short film that's based in this world around these folks, though it is fictional. But to our earlier conversation, you know, ideas aren't just beamed in from outer space. Like, for me at least, I can look over, you know, the films I've made up to this point and the films I hope to make one day, and I can see where I was in my life when I made them and how disparate elements kind of come together and coalesce around this one concept or idea. And so my view of a director is that they are the ultimate filter for the vision that they hold of the thing that they're doing. And so you have to have the ability to pass every suggestion, every question through that filter and decide if it serves the vision or not. Mm-hmm. And only you have that vision. And then you have to know how to communicate that vision to others, because film is inherently collaborative. So you have to work with others and be able to communicate that vision to them in a way that that serves the vision, that helps you fulfill the vision. So
you have like a feeling or a thought process or the whole kind of the cloud of your reactions to this song and these characters. And I mean, how do you vision board that then? And how do you communicate that with the people who work with you on these films?
A lot of conversation, mm-hmm. I think, is sort of my preferred method of doing it. Whenever I am going to make something, I try to spend time with the key people that are going to work on it, certainly the cast and key crew members, and just talk about it a lot. Maybe watch a couple of movies, you know, put together a playlist and send it around. Maybe you see paintings or images, photographs, you know, anything that for me feels of the world, of the piece, you know, I'll try to share with others. But it's hard, you know. There's ultimately sort of something that can't be communicated about what you're doing. And kudos to the people that I've worked with for trusting me that I can bring it together. Like, for instance, on Nordo, I worked with a close friend named Amanda, who served as the production designer on the film, and she had never done production design on a film before, but she's got an incredible eye and is doing interior design. And so I knew she could knock it out of the park, and she did. But something she said after it screened at Indie Memphis that I thought was really funny and great was that she recalled being on set, seeing kind of the chaos of a set, where you're setting up lights, setting up camera, you know, figuring out blocking. And she said she remembered being on set and not knowing how this was going to even resemble like something that felt like a movie, right? She's like, I had no clue how all this was going to come together. And then she saw the film and said, it was like beyond what I could have imagined, but exactly what I envisioned. And I just thought that was great. And so there is something that can't be communicated, that mm-hmm. there is this feeling like, just let me do my thing. I'll show you. I promise that it it will make sense and it will all come together. But this is what we're going for. And I just need you to hang in there with me.
And you have some great actors in your films too, who you could, I mean, they can just convey so much to us. So the most recent film series, film night we had at the Barth House, you were our filmmaker that we showcased. And in our discussion around, we had watched three films, in our discussion, you said, you know what, seeing these three films back to back, I see the device of, I don't know if you said silence or quiet or what you said. And it's true. I feel like that is one of your devices, because that moment that we can see a human being reflecting upon a situation and reacting and digesting it. And also it's like we feel the space that is the human experience, which is very often there's not dialogue. There's not, it's just those moments where you can almost feel, hear the wheels turning kind of thing. Have you thought more on that device that you use, or what do you think about that, how you use that?
Yeah, it's definitely not intentional, and it's not something I even notice I'm doing. And, you know, what you're referring to was seeing those three back to back was something that I had never done, would never do. You know, I'm not sitting at home just hitting play on all my shorts or whatever. But it was something that stuck out to me when you all showed those three films back to back. And I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it means. I mean, there's something about the intimacy of loneliness that I think is compelling, mm-hmm. I guess. But I don't know that I'm even thinking about that. You know, I'm just sort of thinking about that right now as we're talking. But, you know, my mom will probably not like me saying this, but I think I felt lonely a lot as a kid and a teenager because, and that's not maybe a unique experience at all, but, you know, I think that in my quest to understand the world and my place in it, you know, I experienced loneliness because maybe I felt that that was a solo effort, mm-hmm. and that may be showing up, you know, in some of this too.
So for me, like, your work has profound messages, how we as humans behave, like with from the narratives in our own heads. And for me, I see and feel dancing between brokenness and fear and wholeness and peace and like that human experience. So, and for me, that conversation piece is something that I feel like almost revolutionary about. Like, I want everybody to hear me and talk to me about this. So if someone were to watch one of your films and not come away with that same response, like, I feel frustrated, or like, how do we watch the same movie? Like, don't you see the beauty of this experience? And realizing that helps me to see how subjective films can be and how we process them. Like, we filter them through the lens from which we define the human experience and ourselves. So how do you, as the filmmaker, this is your art, relinquish the need to control your audience's interpretation of your work?
That's actually one of my favorite things about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I love that. I love when people say to me, I thought that this is what the ending meant or what happened. And I have my understanding and my intention of what it is, and they're way off from what was in my head about what the ending might be or mean or whatever. But I could care less. You know, I don't feel a need to impose what I think, what I was trying to do with it on someone else. I mean, and that's just so fun to me because it's like almost this sort of instant Rorschach test of where someone else might be. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it powerful. You know, I think that in a broad way, the relationship between art and the viewer or the receiver of a piece, you know, one can't exist without the other. And art will always bring ourselves to a piece. So you and I, of course, can look at a painting or hear a song and feel or think completely different things. And that doesn't mean that the artist did a bad job of communicating themselves. Mm-hmm. It means they did their job.
Yeah.
Because we did have a relationship with the piece, regardless of what they might hope that relationship would be. So I love that. And film specifically is an incredibly visceral form because it brings together sound and image, and in sort of my case, narrative. Though there are obviously documentaries and other types of films, but narrative in and of itself is so powerful because of our sort of ties to story and myth, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're bringing our sort of need to sit around a campfire and share stories into reality with sound and image, and the receiver of that piece is bombarded. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like all their senses are sort of like, you said you could even smell the room, mm-hmm. right? So like all of our senses are bombarded by films. And so it can do that thing in such a powerful way, that thing of forcing someone to bring themselves to it, mm-hmm. in a really visceral way.
It's kind of circle back to your experience with hearing that song in that airport at that time, like us relinquishing the need to know the nitty gritty why and the what, and we, you know, and saying it is,
mm-hmm.
and it's, and letting it breathe. Okay. It's time for us to wrap up,
which,
I hate, because I really feel like I could sit here for a couple more hours and talk to you, Kyle, which we might have to just do.
Nobody wants that.
Y'all got plans. I do want to close up with my plug for the Barth House Episcopal Center, which is a college ministry located on the campus of University of Memphis. In addition to serving our student community, we offer inclusive religious space in our great hall and meeting space for groups, and it's a venue for visual and performing arts. And you can contact us by emailing barthhouse@episwtn.org. And Kyle, could you finish up and give us your plug? How can people find you and the services you offer?
Yes, so my name is Kyle. My last name is spelled T-A-U-B, as in boy, K-E-N. I've been doing that spiel for my entire life because I have a very weird last name. But you can go to kyletopkin.com. You can hit me up there. If you want to see some of these films, some of those are on that site. Some of them I will send to you if you want to write me there and check them out. I'm on Instagram at Kyle Topkin. That's sort of the only social media I've got. So feel free to hit me up.
That's so generous of you. So y'all, you can find the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee on Facebook, Instagram, and at edwtn.org. And you can also listen to past episodes of Faithfully Memphis on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please like and subscribe. It matters. Again, my name is Maggie Schaumleffel for Faithfully Memphis. Until next time, stay safe and stay positive.